Facebook, Google, all of these companies are trying to figure out where are the rules and where are they going to draw the line.
There's clearly a demand for renters. They've got most of them full.
If you own a bond in your retirement portfolio, the price of that is going to go down.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And here we are in the Allstate Skyline studio on this Thursday afternoon. Thanks very much for tuning in. We're going to jump right in. And, you know, one of the beauties of doing this show, I'm going to talk to Brad Meltzer, a friend of mine who has been a friend for years and years. And you develop relationships with people that you never meet, usually talk on the phone or email, things like that. One of those guys is Ian Shura, senior editor at CNET.com. And we've had schedule snafus and different issues for the past few weeks. But, friend, it is so nice to talk to you again. Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thank
you. You can hear me all right, I hope.
I can hear you just fine. Can you hear me
Yeah, we're better now, Okay, yeah. So I'm reading this story about Facebook and the idea that, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, I want privacy. I don't want Facebook to know everything about me. They did a study, and now explain this to me, that Facebook can pretty much create a profile of you by only looking at eight of your friends or eight other people who you know who are on Facebook. A, that's true, they can do that, and B, are they?
So what it is it's actually a study from researchers at the University of Vermont and the University of Adelaide. And what they wanted was figure out how easy it is to identify who you are based on your friends. And a lot of this is really commentary on ourselves and our social circles, because looking at our friends, you know, looking what they post about politics or entertainment, we tend to have people who are very similar to our views.
I see.
On all sorts of stuff.
Okay.
So my friends post a lot about Star Trek, and they post a lot of nerdy memes. So you can then guess, I'll probably do that. And they wrote a program, these researchers, that was able to predict extremely well what I would post, even if I'd
So,
on Facebook because of my friends.
You're breaking in and out there, Ian. But so the point of it then is they're not, if I'm not on Facebook, they can't look at eight of my friends and know where I had dinner last night, but they can figure out where I likely would have dinner tomorrow night.
Correct, exactly. They basically can figure out what I'm interested in.
Right.
Given what I'm likely to be,
And then they can just, I mean, should I be concerned that they have that research, or does everyone have so much that nothing really matters anymore?
Well, I think it speaks a lot to what we share on the internet, and speaks a lot to what our personal interests in and how are and how we kind of interact with that type of stuff. And look, I think that the message is that whether or not you try to avoid social media, it's very easy for people, and especially advertisers, to figure out who you are, regardless of how participatory you are in it.
So I want to jump to the story about WhatsApp. I use WhatsApp, well, not as much anymore, but a few years ago when I was traveling to Europe and my iPhone didn't work as well, I would rely on WhatsApp to communicate with people around the world. And I've never forwarded messages more than, you know, one or two, but it turns out that WhatsApp now has limited how many forwards you can put on a message because people were dying because of WhatsApp forwards?
Yeah, so what happened was that there was the United Nations did an investigation after some of the ethnic cleansing in Myanmar, and they found that Facebook and WhatsApp were partially responsible for kicking all of that off, because people were sharing misinformation and lies and all sorts of crazy stuff around the social networks. And the problem is, it's very hard to control what's on WhatsApp. Unlike Facebook, where they have
public
posts and all that.
Because they're all about being encrypted,
WhatsApp
right, very private, yeah.
Exactly. WhatsApp is all encrypted. You can't see into it. And in fact, WhatsApp itself cannot peer into those messages. So as a result, it became a huge problem. So by cutting down the number of forwards you can do, in theory, this will stop stuff from spreading. Now, of course, you can't stop dedicated to spreading it, but hopefully it might be able to help. And this is all part of Facebook trying to handle these issues before governments really come down on them to fix it.
It is a fascinating story in that the explanation was that last July, five people were reportedly lynched in India after a rumor circulated on WhatsApp that they were child abductors. So a rumor was posted, sent to all of these people. Five people were killed, 12 other people beaten as a result of similar messages. This is fascinating. Okay, one more, because I've kind of given up on trying to understand just exactly what happened with those MAGA hats and the Native American, and I don't understand it all. But Twitter suspended an account that was spreading the video of it. Was this account that Twitter suspended responsible for spreading this story, or were they just one of many?
So this account is as far as people can tell where it started.
Wow.
So this video, it was a minute long. It was viewed, it was posted on Friday, right, which is when this all kicked off, and it was viewed 2.5 million times and retweeted at least 14,000 times, which is fine, right? This is news to a lot of people. But the challenge is that the account claimed to be owned by a California school teacher, but Twitter found that it was actually coming from Brazil somewhere. And so what it seems as though is that this person was not who they said they were, and that raises questions about is this account being used to spread disinformation and misinformation and cause trouble like that? So Twitter suspended the account while they're trying to figure out what's going
on. So no one doubts what happened. I mean, we all can. No one can figure out what happened, but we all know it happened.
Right.
So they didn't make something up, but it sounds to me like this is... it fits in the template of the Russian fake news sort of order. Some account trying to stir up trouble in the U.S. takes a video, spreads it widely, and creates dissent and argument in this country.
Yeah, and the challenge is, right, what is the line between legitimate speech and misinformation and disinformation? And it's really tough when you're dealing with something like this, which is an event that did happen, right? Those protesters were there. The kid was in front of the Native American protester. Like, that video is real. But how it was presented and what it was meant to do when it was posted is where Twitter's concerned.
Ian Schur is a senior editor at CNET.com. Ian, great to talk to you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Steve Bertrand in the Allstate Skyline Studio. Brad Meltzer is coming by a little bit later in the program. He's got a new book out about, there actually was an assassination plot against George Washington. Brad writes great crime fiction. He does a lot of shows on the History Channel and things like that. Remarkable entrepreneur when it comes to creating content. And now he's written this nonfiction book, and he's my buddy. So we're going to talk about that. And he was one of the readers who was brought in to read to the late President Bush in President Bush's final day. So that's coming up. Right now it's time to say hello to Bill Geiger. Our regular conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. And you can take your coat off now. You're inside. It's safe in here.
Well, it's cold outside.
It's cold in this studio's cold too, and it's going to get only a little bit colder.
Yes,
okay, so we talk retirement here with you, and I saw a survey not too long ago of recent retirees.
Right.
I mean, even just recent retirees,
right,
and they were already worried that they didn't have enough income built up for their retirement.
Yeah, you know, we have this conventional wisdom that throughout our life we can just save a lot of money and make a big stack of
right.
it, and then in retirement we can kind of pick at it to support ourselves. The problem, of course, is you go through a big downturn in the market, and you could end up running out of money that way. And folks that are retired, the ones that have planned ahead, Steve, and have created a lot of income for themselves, they're just happy, they're relaxed, they sleep at night, and they're enjoying themselves.
It's funny, I told you off the air, I am no fool, I'm no expert, but I really, until I started doing this show and talking to you, I didn't think about that next step. I just, I thought preparing for retirement was saving for retirement, and accumulating as much as you could on the day you walked out with your retirement party.
Well, it wasn't that many years ago that we had the right process going. As you got closer to retirement, you took some of your money from stock and you put it into bonds. When bonds are paying 6%, 7%, or 8%, there was your income.
Right.
Of course, bonds don't do that anymore. You're lucky to get 2.5% out of them. So you need other strategies to do this.
What kind of strategies? What are we talking about?
There's a number of different strategies depending upon how old you are, how much money you have, how soon you're going to retire, and so on. But the really critical thing is to begin that process as early as possible. We're talking late 50s, early 60s.
Well, I would imagine, too, there are people who do what I thought you were to do, save up the money you need to, and then they can be susceptible to a sudden downturn or crisis, and all of a sudden that nest egg's not there.
Well, think about this. Let's say you're taking 5% out of a stock portfolio.
Okay.
And that's a lot, but maybe you could skim by on that. And your stock portfolio has a 50% loss. If you're drawing the same amount of money out, you're now pulling 10% out of a stock portfolio. That's a recipe for running out of money.
Right.
You cannot depend upon a stock portfolio to last you 20, 25, 30 years in retirement. You really need a part of your portfolio that's dedicated to producing dependable, sustainable income. And that's a big deal.
And when does that happen? We keep saying 50s or 60s, but tell
late
me again.
Late 50s, early 60s. Yeah. Had a couple in yesterday. Ladies retiring early, and she's got a lump sum from her pension plan. She's got her 401k plan, and we're working on it right now. It's just the answer is as soon as possible.
Right, because, and the key is having the wisdom maybe to do that because you might give up on some. When we talk about this, because you take it out of the market doesn't mean you're not going to be making money on your money.
Oh, no. So, some of our growth strategies are 6, 7, 8% a year. In the income strategies, they're still getting 6+% a year. And for a lot of folks, that's not a bad number.
No, I agree. Okay, Bill Geiger, thanks for coming by today.
My pleasure, sir.
So next week, too, let's talk about this because I have this, it's not my theory, but the people coming of age to retire now are kind of the first ones who have been charged with growing their own retirement, right?
They didn't have a pension.
They didn't have a pension.
Yeah.
And it just worries me that we're not ready. I know that's why you're here. You're trying to get us ready, but it's a frightening thing.
Well, Steve, you can actually effectively create a private pension plan for yourself, and maybe we can talk more about that next week.
Bill Geiger, thanks for coming by.
Good to be here, sir.
I appreciate that. Thanks very much, Eric Rung. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. All right, when I talk to authors, I always like to talk to them when they're done with their book tours so that they're good and exhausted and don't want to talk anymore. And that's the case with Brad Meltzer, who joins us on the phone line now. Brad, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
I'll speak to you whenever. I call you, late night, early morning to talk to you.
I was saying earlier, doing this for as long as I do it, it's you develop relationships and friendships, and you certainly are a buddy of mine, so I love talking with you as well. And I want to talk about the book and all, but the book tour is over, right? Was it 14 cities? Did I read that?
14 cities, 14 days, and ended in Chicago in the midst of the snowstorm this past weekend. So it was just perfectly, we couldn't have asked for it to have gone better because this week would have been a total disaster.
And how's that going, the book touring business? Because I think you and I got started even before I was working with Barnes & Noble. But, I did a few years with Barnes & Noble talking to touring authors, and that's dropped off quite a bit. They don't tour authors like they used to. You still get around quite a bit. How have you noticed the audiences, the responses, and things like that?
I think for anyone, and you and I always talk about the business side of these books, as we should, right? I mean, for anyone who's in the business of trying to sell a book today, it's changed in so many ways. Right. One of them, of course, is book tour, where you're right, they don't put authors out, not unless you can get a crowd. And my first events, I remember one of my events, I had two people. Yeah. For the first hour, I had nobody. After an hour, a friend from law school came and brought her mother, right? And I was like, that was when I knew. I was like, okay, we got to do a little better at this. Thankfully, in Chicago, people came.
You're very good at marketing. But I remember talking to authors who, huge writers such as yourself, and it was their nightmare. They'd have an event, and sometimes you just couldn't predict who was going to show up. I mean, once you're at a certain level, you'd get a crowd. But yeah, it was a hit or miss thing sometimes. All right, let's go to a reading that you did, a very special one that was certainly a hit. I was saying when you teasing you earlier in the program that you were one of the authors brought in. I know John Meacham was as well, but you were one of the authors brought in to read to George Herbert Walker Bush in his last days. You read to him the book that we're talking about today, The First Conspiracy, which you write, you could see that he had already written. In fact, he wrote a blurb for it. Tell me about that event.
Yeah, so, you know, this is my first ever nonfiction book, and this was months ago. And what happened was, as you said, I heard they were bringing in some of his favorite authors to read to him, and we knew what was happening at this point. And I got to Kennebunkport, Maine. We were doing a literacy event, actually honor Barbara Bush. And they said, would you like to read to him? And they said, you know, he's sick now. He's only going to last about 10 minutes before he falls asleep because he's just sleeping a lot these days. And I said, of course, I'd be honored. And so I walk into the room, and up on his desk, there are piled about five or six books. And one of them is this book, The First Conspiracy, about the secret plot to kill George Washington. And I'm like, oh, gosh, our book is right there. And it's been, it looks like it's dog-eared, Steve, like read 1,000 times. And I pick up the book, and I brought my copy to read one of my favorite moments, which is when George Washington presents the Declaration of Independence for the first time to the troops. He has it actually read to the troops. And I know what's happening here. I know this is my last moments with President Bush.
Now, you had spent a good deal of time with him in the past, right? The two of you knew each other. He would compliment you on your books. I mean, this wasn't your introduction to George Bush.
No. He's a dear friend. We've done many events together. And he wrote me a fan letter one day for one of my books, and which is the craziest fan letter. I thought it was fake. But This is the moment. It's just myself and my wife, President Bush, his service dog, Sully, and this is the end. We know what's happening. And I start reading that scene. And sure enough, 10 minutes in, he's falling asleep. But I get to that part where those famous words from the Declaration of Independence are read. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. And his eyes pop open. And he is just locked on me, completely aware, completely on target. It's like the words of the Declaration are lifeblood to President Bush right there. And I get to the end of the chapter and I say, sir, you want to read another chapter? And he goes, mm-hmm. Because at this point, he's not really speaking. And I get to another chapter about the secret plot to kill George Washington. I say, another chapter? Mm-hmm. And another? Mm-hmm. And instead of 10 minutes, Steve, I'm there for a full hour.
Wow.
And, you know, to be reading about the first president and the plot to kill him to what is at that point our oldest living president is just one of the great moments of my life, a humbling moment. And when he passed away, I went to the funeral. And the thing that was really struck me is the one word in all the tributes was this word that you heard for President Bush, decency. Decency. And yes, it's because he was a decent man, but I think as a culture today, we're starving for decency. And I love that, you know, sometimes it takes someone like President Bush or, as you read this book, George Washington, to remind you that this country is founded by people who are modest and humble and hardworking and decent. And God, do we need that back.
It's interesting. The funeral and other great events in our history are reflections of our time, just as much as they're reflections of the person who passed. I suppose that's a different way of saying just that. I didn't know about this George Washington assassination plot. And I read an account where you talked to Joseph Ellis, another great historian. He was aware of it, but said it'd be very difficult to prove or to write. Tell me about the plot and why it is you undertook the task of putting it together in a book.
And let's talk about the business side of it, right? I write thrillers. That's what I do. That's supposed to be my business. But I found this story, and every once in a while, we all know all businesses have to pivot. And I found this story about a secret plot to kill George Washington. I found it in the footnotes of all places. And I was like, is this real? Is it fake? And it was real. In 1776, there was a secret plot to kill George Washington. When George Washington found out about it, he gathered up those responsible, built a gallows, took one of the main co-conspirators, and he hanged him in front of 20,000 people.
That's amazing.
It was the largest public execution at that point in North American history. And it became my obsession. And that's where I said, you know, we got to do a book on this. And The First Conspiracy, because it was truly The First Conspiracy, was born.
And it came from within his inner circle or his guards, his security?
Yeah, we'll talk about being careful of who you hire in your business. George Washington had his own private bodyguards, and he asked all of his top regiments to give me your four best men. He personally narrowed it down to about 50 men who became what they called the General's Guard. They called them the Commander's Guard, but the name that stuck was the lifeguards, because part of their job was guarding George Washington's life.
Right.
And these were the men who turned on him. These were the ones involved in the plot.
People will read the story, but I mean, how was it thwarted? How was it that it was discovered?
You know, one of the first things George Washington did is he created a secret committee to look into it. And he put John Jay, who would later become the first Supreme Court justice in charge of it. And they would basically knock on doors, try and find suspects, interrogate them. What they were doing in the process on the secret committee, was called the Committee on Conspiracies, is they were also building America's first counterintelligence agency. And George Washington had to learn to pivot what he was doing. He knows you need a great offense, you need a great army in the Revolutionary War, but you also need a great defense. You need to make sure you know who's coming and get the intelligence. And to this day, CIA headquarters has a room dedicated to John Jay, who they call the founding father of counterintelligence. It all starts in this plot to kill George Washington.
You'd think that if 20,000 people witnessed a hanging, that it would be a widely known American story. But I read an essay you put in the Washington Post about a theory of why it wasn't. The timing of it all, right? It came just at the time that the first draft of the Declaration of Independence was being introduced in Philadelphia.
Yeah, the date of the hanging was June 28th, 1776. Guess what else is happening in the world on June 28th, 1776? Right. You get headlines like, you know, the first draft of the Declaration of Independence is handed in. The British are literally coming. With headlines like that, this just becomes a footnote to history.
The name of the book is The First Conspiracy. Brad Meltzer is the writer, and I love talking to Brad. Are you still working on the I Am books as well?
We are. I can tell you this. The new I Am book is I Am Billie Jean King, comes out in 2 weeks. But the big news we have is that PBS in November is doing a cartoon, national cartoon television show based on the I Am series.
Fantastic.
And so you'll see it's amazing. Yeah, we're thrilled for that. It's called Xavier Riddle in the Secret Museum. It's about Xavier, his sister Yadine, and this is the part you'll love, their best friend Brad, who is the most handsome cartoon character you've ever seen.
I don't doubt it.
And they go back in time for adventures.
The I Am books, if you're not acquainted with them, are famous Americans, but they're written during their childhood as if they're children. And it's a great way to introduce your kids to American icons. Brad Meltzer, an American icon, joins us on the Business Lunch. Great to talk to you, friend.
Always, my friend. Thank you so much for supporting us in all the different genres.
We'll do it. We'll talk again soon. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. If you think there are fewer food trucks around since 2012, well, you'd be right. The number of food trucks has actually cut down to half, only about 65 that are actively driving and selling food on the street right now. And that's because of a city ordinance that's impacting the industry. It says that you can't sell food from a food truck within 200 feet of an establishment that sells food. A number of operators are fighting to say that the rule is unconstitutional, and that was one of the focuses down in Springfield earlier this week. It looks like the struggle will continue in the short run, but we'll see where this goes. And as always, there's never a shortage of money that we'll be fighting over in the business world. And how about the money at the Apple Store? The flagship location is being sold for $79 million. They only owned the building for 18 months, but the next building owner will surely be able to make some money as well, since the lease for the tenants is a 15-year term, and they're right on the river. And we all know that that's a big seasonal attraction. So, anyone have $80 million I can borrow? I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. All right, on a phone line now is Kendall Baker. He is the sports editor at Axios. We talk to folks at Axios quite a lot, one of my favorite websites. But today, we're going to talk not politics, not economics, but squash. Right, Kendall? Welcome to the Biz Lunch.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me on. Great. Yep, squash. It's squash week right now.
There's squash week, a big tournament at Grand Central Terminal in New York. Bring it up here because coming up next, I think it's next month and into March, there's a $1 million squash tournament going to be held in Chicago. So they're trying to build support for that. But tell me about the world of squash and why this is grabbing so much attention this year.
Sure. So I'm actually not, you know, I went to University of Pennsylvania undergrad, where their squash team is actually a pretty big deal, Ivy League, that a lot of the best players are in that conference. So I was pretty aware of squash in college, but I was never a player myself. But I have a few friends who played, and they kind of pointed out to me that this week coming up, kind of around the same time our Axios Sports Newsletter was launching, you know, there's this big annual tournament called the Tournament of Champions, and it's held in Grand Central Terminal. It's a really cool venue. And I figured, you know what, let's cover squash for the whole week, kind of get our readers ingrained in this culture that we hear very little about, and follow along with any, you know, human interest stories that come along. And it's been cool this week to see. You had the semifinals last night, four men, four women, and 7 of those 8 total were from Egypt.
Yeah, right.
I believe the eighth was from New Zealand.
Championship is tonight, and it's a couple of Egyptians. Why is it that the Egyptians dominate this sport?
You know, I was doing some research on it. I assume it's just good training and a kind of golden generation, if you will. This isn't, to my knowledge at least, this has not been a permanent thing in the sport. I think Egypt definitely has a golden generation right now, if you will. Domestically, squash is really just a college sport mainly. They're the best players obviously go pro, but we don't have the same pipeline that they do. So it's pretty spectacular. They have that many champions.
Right, East now. Coast, pretty much, you said, right? And West Coast maybe, but here in the Midwest, not so much.
Yeah, not so much. It was surprising to me though, looking back at this tournament of champions, which has actually existed since 1930. It was called something else, U.S. something, I don't remember the name, but it's actually been in 17 different cities, which was surprising to me, including Detroit. I think Denver, it was in Denver one year, it's in Boston, Philadelphia. It's been at Grand Central since, I believe, 1999, and it's now become a permanent home. But
okay, so, but if it's dominant, if it's dominant on the coast and in the East Coast particularly, explain for me, and I had to look up where the school was, but explain for me Trinity University, because the Trinity University team, at one point, currently has won 252 straight matches, 14 straight national titles. They dominate?
Yeah. Yeah, so I have to apologize to my Trinity College graduate readers who pointed out to me that I incorrectly called it Trinity University, which is actually in Texas, and Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. So my apologies to them. But yeah, it's Trinity College. It's a small liberal arts college, and their men's squash team won 252 straight matches. Wow. From 1998 to 2012, including 14 straight national titles. It's the longest winning streak in college sports history.
That explains why we were just randomly calling people in San Antonio and asking them about squash, and no one knew anything. So that it all makes sense now. All right, championship is tonight. Kendall, I'm betting tonight on the Egyptian. My chances are pretty good, right?
Oh, I 100% chance, all Egyptian final, which is really something.
Kendall Baker's the sports editor at Axios. Thanks for taking time today. I know it's a busy day for you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
You bet. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.